Session number 8177, Wing Commander David Shannon, Reel 1.
Where were you born, Wing Commander Shannon?
I was born in South Australia, in Unley, on the 27th of May, 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was the director of the South Australian Farmers Union, and he was a politician all his life. His father before him had also been a director of the South Australian Farmers Union, and he also was a politician for his working life.
Where were you educated?
I was educated in South Australia. Firstly, we moved from the surrounds of Adelaide up to the Mount Lofty Ranges to a little place called Bridgewater. And I did my primary school education at the Bridgewater Public School. And my secondary education, up to matriculation standard, was done at the Unley High School.
By public school, is that the same
no,
as what
No, that's the public school in the sense of England. Australia's public schools are state schools. And what we call public schools here in England are grammar schools in Australia.
So when you left school, what did you take up as a career?
Well, I left school because my education, of course, was during the period of the Depression. And I left school at matriculation, didn't go on to university, and started in insurance, working in Adelaide with a Western Assurance Company. And then, of course, the outbreak of war. On my 18th birthday, which was 1940, I went with a friend of mine to join the Navy. But there was a tremendous waiting list to get into the Navy of volunteers at that time. And so I decided, rather than wait for the period, I would go around the corner and apply to join the RAAF, Royal Australian Air Force. I was accepted there and told to just await my call-up.
What happened then?
Well, I continued working until I was called up, and then my call-up came. If I can refer back to my logbook, at the end of 1940, I received a letter saying that I was accepted and that I would be being sent to Western Australia for flying training. And I see again from my logbook that I arrived in Pearce, which was the large RAAF establishment outside Perth, on the 5th of January 1941. That was for initial training, which was nothing to do with the flying, but was the schooling, where we learnt the Morse code, navigation, carried on with mathematics, and all of the things of an educational nature that they wanted to instill into us before we went off to start our flying training.
Where did you do that?
The first part of my elementary flying training was carried out at a place called Cunderdon in Western Australia, which is in the vicinity of the Kalgoorlie Goldfields area. There we learnt to fly tiger moths, and I was afterwards from Cunderdon sent to Geraldton, which was on the northwest of Perth, where we learnt to fly twin-engined aircraft, Ansons, in those days.
So how did you come to be in the RAF?
I was never in the RAF. I was always in the Royal Australian Air Force, seconded to the Royal Air Force. After completing training in Australia, I was commissioned as a pilot officer and sent across with a whole host of other volunteers at that time via the States to England. We came across from, we left from, embarked from Sydney and came across and landed in San Francisco, travelling over on the Matson line, and then we were put on a train in San Francisco and then trained across to Halifax, the whole way up through the States and across Canada to Halifax, where we embarked in a troop ship and a convoy and crossed the Atlantic to Liverpool and arrived sometime, as far as I can recall, toward the end, November-December time of 1941. So that was the best part of a year had been spent training and getting across to this country.
Now, can we jump ahead and can you tell me how you came to join 617 Squadron?
Well, it's I'll have to go through, I think, historically a little bit. Having arrived in England, we were first sent to do a further advanced flying training course at Cranwell, which was completed in about a month or so. And then we were sent to an operational training unit in Scotland, Kinloss, and we did our operational training, which again was a six-month course, on Whitleys, flying there. And it was from Kinloss that I was posted from there to 5 Group Bomber Command to do conversion firstly from Whitleys onto Manchester's, and then from Manchester's, which I flew for a short time, onto Lancaster's, and I was seconded to number 106 Squadron in 5 Group. I had completed a complete tour with 5 Group. The commander of that squadron at the time was Wing Commander Guy Gibson, so I had been with him the whole time. And I'd completed 36 ops, something more than a tour with them. In those days, they considered a first tour of operations to be 30 operational trips. I'd done 36. I wanted to keep flying, and I had asked for a posting to 8 Group, which was the Pathfinder Force. And I had been posted from 106 Squadron to 83 Squadron at Witten. I'd only been at Witten, I suppose, 2 or 3 days when I got a call through from Gibson asking whether I would rejoin him again, as he had been asked by the AOC of 5 Group to form a special squadron for a special operation.
Were you given any details about it?
At that time, we were given absolutely no details at all. Gibson was given no details. We had no idea what was in the offing at all. But having served with Gibson for quite a long period, full tour, I was very happy to say, yes, I will drop the idea of going into PFF, and if you can pull the necessary strings, I will come to you.
And this...
The necessary strings were pulled, and I was picked up from Witten and flown to Scampton, where the squadron was being formed.
Could you make some estimate of Gibson as a man?
Oh, he was an absolutely fantastic character. I should think, in my own estimation, that he was one of the finest leaders of men that I've ever met. He was a type of chap that would never ask anybody to do anything that he couldn't do or hadn't done himself. And he was what was known in the RAF terms as an operational squadron commander. That is to say that he flew just as much on operations operationally as his crews did, which was not always the case with squadron commanders because they had plenty of administrative work and other things to do. And many of them were there for quite a long period of time to get in their full tour of operations. But Gibson was a fantastic leader. He was very strict on duty and one of the boys off duty. And he managed to carry that off to perfection. Everybody admired him, and having been with him for over a year at that stage, you know, I was very happy to continue serving with him.
Was he a personal friend of yours?
Personal friend of mine, yes, yes. We struck up quite a very close personal friendship, as one did during the war, as close as one could.
How good a pilot was he?
Oh, an excellent pilot, first-class pilot, really, first-class pilot.
Now, I interrupted you, the narrative, with you actually joining 617 Squadron and arriving at Scampton, so could you take it from there?
Well, we arrived at Scampton. I think Gibson had been told, because he also had left 106 for a rest period when he was recalled, at very much the same time that I left the squadron. And that was probably sometime about mid-March 1943. I got the message from him toward the end of March, and I was arrived in Scampton, I think it was the 28th or the 29th of March. So things were moving very rapidly. When we arrived there, of course, it was a brand new squadron. There was no equipment, no aeroplanes, no nothing, and so the first job was to get the whole thing going. It was a mammoth job for Gibson to form a create a new squadron from scratch. I mean, the squadron hadn't even been designated as a squadron with a number at that time. It was just known as Squadron X for quite a long time. But Gibson was given carte blanche, and he personally, with the aid of the Sasso from 5 Group, chose all of his crews that he wanted to form this new and special squadron. I, as I say, had been selected from 106. Also from 106 was a great friend of mine, was John Hopwood. And Hoppy, as he was known, was called, and a Canadian, another pilot from the squadron, Flight Sergeant Purpey. So they were the three, and we were, I think, probably the first three that Gibson chose because he knew us. And then he went through the records of other aircrew and selected the squadron the whole way around until he'd built up a force of 2 flights, 21 crews in total, including himself, i.e. as a squadron commander, and then 2 flights, each of 10.
Did he ever discuss with you any likely people to recruit?
No, no. By the time we got there, all of the selections had been made by Gibson and by the people that were assisting him in 5 Group headquarters, and they slowly congregated together, so that by about the end of the first week in April, the entire squadron had been formed. That is 21 crews, which was 7 per crew, so there's 143 men, air crew, and the supporting ground staff, mechanics, fitters, administrative staff and everything, something like 500 men there from ground staff people. So it was a mammoth operation to undertake in such a short space of time. But he was given full assistance. I mean, the orders had come down on high from Bomber Command through 5 Group to get on with this because time was short. Nobody knew why time was short, but that was the orders that had been given, and so the squadron was formed.
What about the arrival of the equipment? Did that go smoothly?
That went quite smoothly. I mean, firstly, we got just, I think we had 10 conventional Lancasters bombers, which we started training on. And the training was for low flying at in daylight formation flying. And we were told that we had to practice flying at 150 feet and in formation. And once we'd perfected that and could navigate all around the country, we would move on and start flying at night in moonlight periods. Well, as you know, there's not an awful lot of moonlight periods available in this country, even in the summer. So we did a lot of very early morning flying and a lot of dusk flying to try and simulate the light rather than the full light. Even then we weren't getting sufficient practice in, and so I think it was Americans had come up with some form of simulation of light to simulate moonlight, so that the cockpit of the aircraft was covered in blue perspex, and we were to wear yellow goggles, complementary colours, and fly during daylight with that type of fitments done to the aircraft, and that was as near as we could get to moonlight flying. So we had quite a few airplanes fitted out like that. We all did two or three cross countries in those sort of conditions, in daylight, to get in the amount of practice that we wanted.
Was it successful, that simulation?
The simulation was quite successful, a little bit hairy to start with, but sort of taking off with these things on, you know, in a bright day, one tended to want to take off the goggles and see what was going on. But we very soon got accustomed to it, and it worked very well indeed.
Did it create any special strain, such as on the eyes?
No, I don't think so. Nothing of any serious nature, anyway, that one noticed to that extent.
What about the low-level flying? Had you personally done such low-level flying?
Well,
yourself?
We had done a certain amount of low-level flying in my first two of operations, because I was on several of the daylight raids there, which were done at low level. The first one I did was to Danzig and back. That was about a 10-hour flight. And then I was on the Le Creusot daylight raid, on the Milan daylight raid. We also did a daylight raid into Essen in the Ruhr one time. And of course, at that time, all daylight flying was done at low level, to avoid any fighters, because if you kept down on the deck, of course, the chances of fighter attacks were lessened by a very large degree. But to the extent of continual low flying, I don't think anybody in Bomber Command had flown to the extent that we were expected to train and reach the peak of perfection that we had to do. It was, all of this was going on, of course, and we at that time had no idea why we were being trained, what the target was going to be, or why this was happening. But the three major points that were made to Gibson were that we had to fly in formation, low-level flying and navigation, which became literally map reading, because the navigational aids that we had at that time were not frightfully effective at the low level, and we were flying mostly over the land. Apart from crossing the North Sea into enemy territory, it was pinpoint flying from one strip to another. So to reach a form of perfection in this, we mapped out about 8 or 10 different cross-country routes. Flying time about 3.5 to 4 hours, and all of the navigators made varying strip maps of the sections, so that we did all of the navigation virtually by map reading on these flights.
Whereabouts did you do most of the training?
Well, we were based in Scampton, and we were flying all over the country. We were flying up as far as up to Scotland, all through the Midlands. We did quite a bit of practicing up around the hills around Sheffield and beyond, up through there, and down as far as into Wales, so that we had a fairly good coverage. But of course, once these varying cross-country routes had been planned, all of the stations and patrols and anti-aircraft systems in this country at the time were warned of this, because in the early days there were nothing but complaints and confusion coming in to Bomber Command headquarters, that everybody was sighting Lancasters flashing all around the country at a very low level, and what the hell was going on. So it was all rather took a long time to sort of sort that out.
Did the complaints create any unpleasantness for you?
No. We as crew members were well removed from any complaints. I think the complaints were perhaps more the sufferers were the intelligence officers and the group commanders and the base commanders, who perhaps hadn't given sufficient warning to varying people that we were flying on a specific day, or what was happening, what was going on. But by and large, no, there was no real serious problem there. Of course, what did transpire, because unbeknownst to us at the time, Gibson was having varying meetings with group and with the specialists, and particularly the research departments, and he was let in to the secret, I suppose, early, mid-April, no, end of April, I should think, about the end of April, what the target was to be and what the bombs were to be, the bomb load was to be. And it was at that period of time that the experiments were being carried out of dropping the mines, which we eventually dropped, to see how they performed. And tests were carried out down off the coast, Margate, Parkston, dropping these things. And they found that dropping them from a speed of something like 240 miles an hour, from 150 feet, the casings just shattered. And so they, Barnes Wallace, the designer of the mine, and his research team, had to keep working on this. And they came up with a solution that the only way, if they wanted to carry out this operation, was to fly at 232 miles an hour and drop the mines from 60 feet. And so it was about halfway through our training where the height of flying was dropped from 150 feet to 60 feet. Now, flying at 60 feet in daylight or thereabouts is a very different kettle of fish from flying at 60 feet at night. And the only way that we could fly at that sort of level without killing ourselves was with very accurate altimeter. Now, there was no altimeter sufficiently accurate designed at that stage to allow us to contour fly at 60 feet. So, again, the research people came up with the idea that the only way that they could overcome this was to put a spotlight in the nose of the aircraft and a spotlight in the tail of the aircraft, and set the beams, set the angle of these lights so that they converged into one spot at an exact height of 60 feet below the aircraft. And that is eventually how the whole raid was carried out, using that to get the exact height that was required. But of course, from having flown around the country at 150 feet, we then had to start flying lower and lower the whole time. And so it was the low flying, the formation flying, the height, were the major problems to resolve and train for. And then the secondary problem that cropped up was communications, because we must have communications between ourselves at that time. And of course, in Bomber Command, the only radio equipment was normal radio control on a medium wave, which was used purely and simply for landings and takeoffs from base, and then there was radio silence the whole time. So we were the aircraft were not fitted with the right sort of communication equipment, and eventually they got hold of VHF equipment and a special wavelength which we were able to use, similar to the type of equipment that was fitted in fighter aircraft.
How did it work?
Well, that worked quite well, but of course there again we had to have quite a bit of practice on it and needed some experience to see how that would go.
What was the main problem with using it?
I think the main problem with using it was not so much of using it. Once we got the equipment, there was no problem. It was resolving a code to restrict the amount of traffic over the VHF RT and stop people from sort of conducting sort of conventional talk over it. And so we had to devise varying codes of what we were doing.
Can you recollect any?
Well, we had the codes for the actual operation, varying code words that we had for when the dams would be exploded. But no. I think we had nigger was one that they would use. It was just a series of code words that they picked out to go through.
Now, what about the spotlight system? Did that work well, or were there any problems?
The spotlight system, once we got it, worked very well indeed. It was we did a lot of practice up and down the main runway at Scampton and over the aerodrome. Try it there, and we then practiced flying.